Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 21st, 2018. The U.S. Department of Commerce imposes sanctions on 15 South Sudanese oil companies, including NilePet.
The oil sector in South Sudan is being targeted exclusively and significantly. The Ministry of Mining is being targeted here. The South Sudan Ministry of Petroleum and all other state-owned oil companies.
And South Sudan's health minister says the country is now free of guinea worm.
We are not going to be complacent. We are going to redouble our efforts to step up our surveillance program. And through what we call the Boomer Health Initiative, we are going to make use of the very strong infrastructure that has been put in place by the Carter Center.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. government slapped restrictions on companies doing business with 15 South Sudanese oil-related entities. The companies were added to a Department of Commerce entity list that would impose license requirement. The license requirement applies to any transaction in which items are to be exported, re-exported, or transferred involving the companies. The U.S. says the 15 entities and 8 other non-South Sudanese companies listed in today's announcement have acted, quote, contrary to the national security or foreign policy interest of the United States. For more analysis on this latest development, my colleague Carol Van Dam spoke with Brian Adeba, Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project, who says today's action is a comprehensive and gets at the core of what is fueling the war in South Sudan.
And that's the oil sector, and it's significant for the number of entities that it has listed and also other entities in other countries. So what we have really here is the oil sector in South Sudan is being targeted exclusively here. You have a number of companies, and significantly the Ministry of Mining is being targeted here. The South Sudan Ministry of Petroleum and all other state-owned oil companies like SAD Petroleum, like Nile Petroleum Corporation.
And are those the big ones, the ones that you see mentioned in there? Are those the biggies?
Oh, yeah. For instance, NilePet is the major government corporation that's involved in oil drilling and in giving concessions to foreign oil companies. And then you have subsidiaries or affiliates like SAIPET Engineering and Consultancy Services, Dar Petroleum, and others. So this is really very significant, and it really gets at the core of what's happening in South Sudan in terms of how the oil resource itself is used to sort of advance the objectives of war.
Now, how exactly will this be put into play, and what does it do to these entities, including the Ministry of Mining and the Ministry of Petroleum?
What will happen here is that the ability of other companies globally to transact businesses with these companies is now going to be under jeopardy. This is a warning to other companies that says, if you deal with these South Sudanese companies, you are breaking U.S. law and therefore liable for action by under U.S. jurisdiction. So this, what will happen is companies will shy from doing businesses with these South Sudanese companies. And I think what really needs to happen in terms of how to mitigate the impact here is we need to see benchmarks. What do the South Sudanese need to do in order not to be targeted by these U.S. measures that have just been announced?
Now, you're saying this will choke off the supply of the money that the government was using to buy weapons, right?
That will impact it considerably, because the oil resource is the only means through which the government actually is able to get foreign currency and buy weapons using that foreign currency, and also, of course, to pay other to finance the activities of government. But the oil resource is the key here, really. It's the lifeline of South Sudan. It's you know, South Sudan has failed to develop other alternative sources of revenue, and it's oil that it relies on. The ability of the government to get any financing for any of the things that it wants to do, and especially in this regard, it's the war.
We used to report a couple of years ago that it was 98% to 99% of the entire budget for what they were revenue streams, you know, from what they were taking in. Is it still that close, even though their oil production has been depleted somewhat?
Yes, that's true. I mean, like, the figure that we have on record is 98%. Although the oil production has itself reduced, that figure is still largely accurate because no other sources of revenue have been developed.
Now, you, and when I say you, I mean the Enough Project and some other organizations have been pushing for this for some time, right?
We have said that targeting a few individuals and a few companies is not advisable in the long run. Targeting them, you know, like you target two individuals today and then you take another 6 months to target another two individuals is counterproductive, actually. What you really need to do is you target a wide range of individuals, their associates, their networks, and the companies that they own or entities that they are affiliated with, and also target entities that are affiliated to sort of sourcing money and contributing to the financing of the war. And this measure here is itself welcome. What needs to be done here is to continue escalating these measures so that the ability of the actors in this war to perpetuate what they're doing is greatly reduced.
But this is pretty wide-ranging. There are a number of companies, including the big ones, like you said, the big government oil-run companies. So does this not satisfy you, the Enough Project, and other organizations that have been trying to get something like this done?
Well, until we begin to see the impact, really, is a move in the right direction. There should be no slacking in ensuring that they are replicated elsewhere as well. And at this particular point, this is the United States doing this. Its partners in the global community need to replicate the measure. For instance, I think the Europeans need to come aboard with such a move as well.
That's Brian Adeba, Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project here in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam earlier today. The IGAD Council of Ministers says it is disappointed by what it calls the failure of South Sudan government and the SPLM-IO to investigate reports of violations of the cessation of hostility agreement or to hold individuals violators accountable. Both the government and the armed opposition deny violating the deal, as we hear from Michael Atit from Juba.
In late January, the IGAD Council of Ministers asked the government and the SPLA-IO to provide reports of violations to the Ceasefire and Transitional Security Arrangements Monitoring Mechanism, or CITISAM, a body monitoring the ceasefire agreement. The IGAD Council of Ministers said it is dismayed to learn that in parts of the country the violations continue. SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwang claims the SPLA has nothing to report because it forces committed no violations.
If IGAD has a proof beyond reasonable doubt that there are individual commanders in the SPLA who had been in violation of a cessation of hostilities agreement, they should bring that to the attention of the political leadership for it to be addressed at the political level. But as far as I know, is that we are not in violation of cessation of hostilities agreement as the National Army, and we also do not have individual commanders who had violated the cessation of hostilities agreement.
Kwang blames the armed opposition for violating the agreement and accuses ceasefire monitors of ignoring those violations.
And up to now, CITISAM have not said anything about the violations carried out by the rebels, taking up new offensive positions, rearming, recruiting, cutting off some government-controlled towns, encroaching on our defensive positions in places like Nasser, Wad, Pangak, and a number of and places in Raja, and yet they have been quiet.
SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampol Gabriel counters it is the government that attacks the rebels' positions.
No, we are not violating. The government is busy doing this even of reason. They attacked us in around Morobo. And about a month ago, they attacked us in close to Ye, on Ye Maridi Road. They did this. They even crossed to Uganda. and attack the raided cattle and blame it on us. This is wrong. This is a violation.
Gabriel praised the monitors for doing their job, but says it is wrong for CITESAM to blame the warring parties without providing evidence to back their accusations.
We know we have not been on the wrong. We have just been provoked, and now we have been defending ourselves to that.
IGAD says lack of action by both parties to investigate violations and hold perpetrators accountable is non-compliance to Article 13 of the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement. IGAD's Council of Ministers reiterated its determination to take appropriate actions against any part that does not comply with its duty to investigate and report accountability measures taken against the perpetrators of violations of the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement. In a report published by CITESAM on January 15th, the monitors say SPLA personnel stole property including motorcycles, bicycles, food items, and bedding from the people of Bangolo of Mundiri. The report says all the evidence suggested that clash was caused by SPLA troops moving into areas dominated by SPLA IO loyal to Riek Machar forces. The CITESAM also says SPLA IO Riek Machar forces attacked Koch in former Unity State on December 24, 2017. The report on the CITESAM website says by attacking Koch on December 24th, the SPLA-IO Riek Machar forces were in clear and blatant violation of the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement, particularly in Article 1 and 3, stating all hostilities, actions and attacks on civilians' population are illegal. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan is free of Guinea worm. That's according to Health Minister Riek Gok. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what type of work do you enjoy?
I enjoy computing. Yeah, that's all. Because it gives me happiness every time that I do it.
Law is good. Law is good. I love the legal profession because it involves me and you. It's not like me alone.
I enjoy maybe working like in an office. Maybe my clients come to me like of that kind, not moving so much in the kind of work I'm doing.
I don't work, but I play football. So that's my work. Only football and schooling. Yeah, because it's one of my career and I like it the most.
I am a nurse, so I like caring for older people because at that stage, they can't do anything. How they eat, taking care of themselves, it's a problem to them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. There is no more transmission of Guinea worm disease in South Sudan. South Sudan Health Minister Dr. Riek Guy Gok made the announcement today at the Carter Center headquarters in southern state of Georgia, noting zero cases of Guinea worm disease have been reported in the country for the past 15 consecutive months.
We don't have the illusion of that the job is finished. No, we are not going to be complacent. We are going to redouble our efforts to step up our surveillance program, and through what we call the Boomer Health Initiative, we are going to make use of the very strong infrastructure that has been put in place by the Carter Center.
Health workers began a campaign to eradicate Guinea worm disease in 2005 after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. South Sudan's health minister says the accomplishment would not have been made possible without the work of the Carter Center, named after former U.S. President Jimmy Carter.
And having known the suffering that it inflicts to the people, one is really very happy today that the future generation will just read it in the books as part of history. And one is really very proud, and all of us should be proud, that we are part of that history in making. That one day, people will just say, one day there was something called Guinea worm, but it's not there. Maybe only in the textbooks.
Over 20,000 cases were reported in South Sudan in 2006. By 2015, the Ministry of Health announced that no cases were reported in 7 months beginning in November 2014. Only 6 cases were reported in 2016. Guy says this marks an important day for South Sudan.
And to us, as South Sudanese also, we would feel we have contributed to the common cause of humanity of our day, today, that we have played our part. We have played our part in realizing that dream of eradicating and ridding the world of this debilitating disease called the guinea worm.
Guinea worm disease is contracted when people drink contaminated water that has guinea worm larva, which then grows inside the victim's body. It eventually presents itself in a painful blisters on the skin. The Carter Center says community-based interventions, including educating people on the disease and promoting the use of filtered water, help eradicate the disease in South Sudan. The Wau State government has ordered dozens of residents who have built homes near the railway station in Wau Town to vacate the area within 7 days or be forcefully evicted. But residents say even though they illegally built their homes in the area, government should allocate land for them to build new homes. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Wau.
The government says more than 120 households have illegally occupied the Wau railway station despite several warnings to vacate the area. The Sudanese government terminated operations of the Wau Khartoum railway line in 2010, shortly before South Sudan declared its independence. Wau State Minister for Physical Infrastructure Mario Nyibong John says residents need to clear out so workers can improve the railway line connecting South Sudan with Sudan.
We even gave them a ministerial order 2 months ago, give them like 2 months to relocate from that place, okay? And I even went to the place and I told them, now you have 2 months, that was in January. You have 2 months to put your thing in order and let you relocate from this place. Some were agreeing, some were disagreeing, and I told them this is an institution. Dinia is an institution, okay? And if I don't get, come and occupy it.
John says Juba and Khartoum are determined to rehabilitate the railway line to facilitate cross-border trade. Santino Deng Arias is one of the residents who lives at the railway station. Speaking in Arabic, he claims some of those living near the railway station are children.
The children that are staying here in this area are the children of soldiers. These soldiers were taken to the front lines and some did not come back, and their children remained here. There is no way that one can go and do something anywhere without money. You, the government, give us time. You have to think about allocating these people land.
Speaking in Arabic, another resident who prefers to be identified only as a Chol for fear of reprisals from officials says residents need at least a year to find other land and build a house.
Asa, mother, Garab.
We have 9 years staying here at railway station site. Someone might have had her husband killed during this conflict, but stay with the children and maybe others still alive with their husbands. Our problem is that give us time and also allocate us the place that we can go and be there. But not now. It should be next year, such that everyone should be ready for his or her new allocated plot.
Horatio Udo Madut is a youth leader in Wau Town. Speaking in Arabic, Madut agrees that the government should provide land to the affected families and individuals.
If the government says people have to live, it is the government that is responsible. The civilians are not responsible, but we need relocation.
John says those willing to vacate the premises will be sold new plots.
This railway station is a government place, and no one has the right to go and settle there without permission. No one can permit you to occupy government land. They have to permit you in areas allocated for settlement. This order is still effective, and in the coming days they will be asked to quit and settle in areas which will be allocated to them, like Marial Bay and Alel Chok.
John warns that his squatters who resist the government order to leave will be forcefully evicted. Some of the audio used in this story was recorded by Wau-based journalist Deng Dimo. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
African Union heads of state today launched what could become the world's largest free trade zone, the African Continental Free Trade Area. But with 54 countries in the African Union, each with its own economic and political concerns, the effort has many hurdles to clear before it can become a reality. VOA's Daniel Schaff reports from Nairobi.
Handshakes, smiles, and jubilation accompanied the long-awaited launch of the African Continental Free Trade Area on Wednesday in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. The trade bloc has been in negotiation since 2012, when the African Union first decided on a continent-wide plan. It aims to create a single market for goods and services, free movement of business and investments, and establish a customs union to regulate tariffs. As part of a related action plan, the African Union aims to double intra-African trade by 2022. Erastus Mwencha is former deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission and former secretary general of the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa.
Africa is one continent that does not trade with itself like the rest of the world. And because of that, the huge demographic dividend of the continent is not of any advantage to the continent because Africa has not taken advantage of its market size, which is 1.3 billion people plus a GDP of over 2.3 trillion.
But the Kigali launch, while significant, is largely symbolic, as many challenges remain before the trade deal can be implemented, let alone become effective. Gerishon Ikiara is Associate Director of the Institute of Diplomacy and International Studies at the University of Nairobi and an economist. He notes that Africa faces many political, social, and economic barriers to integration.
There is also often a bit of conflict between the French-speaking Africa, the English-speaking Africa, the Maghreb, Arab parts of Africa in North Africa. Then you have a few dominant economies like South Africa and Nigeria, and the small ones like Rwanda.
African trade is dominated by the export of raw materials to Asia and the West and import of finished goods. One of the reasons is because national markets operate like silos, says Mwencha.
If you look at some of the economies in Africa, with a population of 500,000 people, a population of 3 million people, population of 5 million people, with very little purchasing power, you cannot be able to really advance economically, and so you require a bigger market.
The African Union says reducing barriers to trade within the continent will boost manufacturing and value-added products and services. In his keynote address at the summit Tuesday, African Union chairperson and president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, noted less than 20% of Africa's trade is internal, compared to three times that in other trade blocs like the European Union. Part of the problem is that incentives for trade are skewed toward off-continent partners. Mwencha says intra-African tariffs average around 12%, while Africa charges the rest of the world only about 8%.
So that is a misnomer that really charity begins at home. I mean, we are not giving each other advantage. And because of that, the cost of doing business in the continent, whether it is trade facilitation, is also very high. So this is, to me, a significant movement.
But just days before the launch, Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, announced President Muhammadu Buhari would not attend. A government statement said key stakeholders, a reference to the business community and trade unions, had not been consulted about their concerns on the treaty. Some economists warned that without Nigeria's participation, the African CFTA will be severely handicapped. However, national consultations are understandable, says Mwencha.
That is okay, but one hopes that this doesn't drag because Nigeria perhaps may take a position that is a large country with almost 170 million people that they can do without continent. That will be a very unfortunate position.
For the 44 countries who signed on to the deal this week, the next step will be getting their national parliaments to ratify the free trade deal, which could take years. The 10 other countries in the AU would also have to sign on for the deal to be continent-wide. Regional integration could be a bigger challenge for Africa than it was for Europe. But while the EU took more than half a century to establish itself with just 28 members, economists like Ikiara expect it will take years, not decades, for Africa.
Right now also we are having improvement in terms of infrastructure. Ports which are connected with each other, railways and roads which are interconnecting more African countries. And I think that connectivity, I see it as being a major push, because once the interconnectivity is improved, the private sector becomes even more effective.
Despite the challenges ahead, the trade bloc's launch Wednesday is another step by African nations toward closer integration. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Still in Nairobi, the United Nations Refugee Agency says some 3.5 million refugee children are not able to attend school. A majority are in Africa, where they have suffered loss, dislocation, and other trauma from war and conflict in their home countries. A three-day regional meeting in Nairobi this weekend brought together policymakers, education experts, campaigners, and representatives from UN agencies to seek ways to address the problem. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
Teams from Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, and Uganda took part in the deliberations. Issues included the impact of conflict and natural disasters on providing education, inequalities among marginalized groups, and sustainable access to quality education. Leonora McEwen is a program specialist at the International Institute for Educational Planning.
It's a global crisis with more than 65 million displaced population, displaced people throughout the world, of which half of those are children, right? So one in 45 children are refugees today. Increasingly displacement last years, right? So children are missing entire education cycles, and we're missing out generations of learning. So it's the scale is enormous, and 80% of refugees are actually in developing countries.
According to the United Nations, developing countries, mostly in Africa, are taking a disproportionate number of refugees, about 80% of the world's refugee population. South Sudan is among the countries in Africa engulfed in civil war. Deng Deng Hok is the country's Minister of Education.
We have still 1.8 million children out of school. We have about 2 million, just over 2 million in our schools, which is a big achievement compared to, 300,000 in 2006. We still need to improve the quality of education. Currently, it is variable from one school to another. We need to invest in in-service teacher training. We need to implement the new school inspection system. There are many reforms that need to be implemented to address the issues of access, quality, and equity.
Refugees hosted in developing countries put enormous pressure on education, water, and healthcare systems in host communities. In Kenya, for example, hundreds of thousands of refugees and asylum seekers, mostly from Somalia and South Sudan, have been living in the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps. Kenya's Director of Education, Robert Masese, says hosting the displaced populations brings challenges.
I was handling an issue about the conflicts between the refugee community in the Dadaab refugee camp.
Governments in Eastern Africa have made significant progress enrolling refugee children in school. Campaigners say refugee children are five times less likely to attend school than other children. Even for those who can access education, the quality is almost invariably poor. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Wednesday. I'm John Tanza in Washington under a heavy cover of snow. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.